didn't just forget us of that.
I will. Don't let that line. Uh-oh, what about Ken Johnson? From last time? From last, I do have the special one, and I have all the.
Okay, we're ready, okay. Can I call this meeting to order, please? This is a continued workshop, here at the County Public Works Department on the, LDAS recommendations for changing, road standards. Now, I'd like to, start this meeting out with, Public Works, recently had a sub-meeting, in planning with, Rob Randles and his staff came over, and we did go over this, and now I need to know kind of what your outcome was from all of that.
Well, the road standards really, they're not really a land use function. They're a road standard. The current road standards we have here are adopted by the Board of County Commissioners, and it's a different process. It doesn't go through the rural land development planning commission. So I'm not certain how David would want to handle that unless he wants to take it as a two-step process.
My feeling after the meeting that we had when Rob Brandis and Chuck were identifying those portions of the recommendations from LDAC that are really in the engineering standards of the code is just to identify those. I feel that we go to public hearing with the LDAC recommendations intact as written, recognizing that certain portions of those really need to be adopted as part of engineering standards. And part of the reason we don't want to adopt them as part of the RLDC is every time we change this document, we go through a land use hearing, it's a billable LUVA, it's a much more onerous process. By adopting something into the engineering standards manual, if the AASHTO standards or new information, bridge loading, any of those kind of things come out, those can be adopted into an engineering manual much more easily without going through the land use process. Also, planners don't like to put engineering standards in our code. So, but I think because the LDAC standards sort of blended those things together in the recommendation, my take on it would be, let's just go there with the language. We understand it as a cohesive document. But recognize that there's portions of that that when it comes time to actually adopt something would go to the engineering standards. Does that make sense?
Would it make sense to take out the parts that would go to the engineering standards? So if we take it to the hearing and they're still and they're all mixed in together, wouldn't that be confusing?
Part of the issue with doing that, I think, is that you'd be referencing standards that we didn't have there. I mean, we'd have to maybe come up with a separate document that would say these are the standards, but engineering has yet to sign off on what standards that are part of the recommendations, is my understanding. So,
and the other thing is what happens if the commissioners would approve one but not the other? So you have a bunch of conflicting.
So we were concerned that we didn't want to change the language of the LDAC, but they figured if we bring it to the public, then we ferret it out at that point. And what we would do is go down each one of these one at a time and give public input on a gradation for each one of these individual changes that you want to make on what we live with, what we can't, what we feel will be an engineering standard, then we'll have to point it over to them. But the public should have your recommendations because you were a body that was appointed to do this particular job. And I don't want to lose the essence of that with us trying to mold it into something that maybe it wasn't. It is not. This is not going to be an easy process, I don't think.
I totally understand that you don't want to have, you know, redundant things in two different places, or when you update one, then you have to make sure that's just a nightmare. I mean,
especially with two different processes.
Right.
That's what they're talking about. Right.
And we can get the public input at that time, and we can put it over here, and the public will know what we're doing too at the same time. They're not just making arbitrary decisions.
Chuck, what's the process for adopting the engineering manual? That goes directly to the Board of Commissioners as a recommendation from staff.
I'd like a little bit. I think we should have some clarification, I should say, before we go to the public hearing on a couple of points. One, as far as Public Works being the ones that write the rules for the roads, and RLDC shouldn't do it. I can agree with that, but RLDC does have standards for driveways. And if we do end up improving private roads, is Public Works going to want to, or will they be able to take jurisdiction over the private roads more?
It's not that I'm taking jurisdiction, but I would write. It's not that I take jurisdiction, but I would write out in the table, you know, that has all the different roads. It would be one that just said private road, and it's whatever the minimum standards were.
So should we take the Article 76 road standards and pass them off to Public Works someday?
Well, Article 76 is not a road standard; it's a driveway standard.
Okay, but a private road and a driveway seem awful similar.
One serves one lot, one serves multiple lots.
What we kind of really focus on is how many lots we're going to stick onto this, and then we want to change the standard. That's why the more we got into this, we kept looking at the same thing. Where's the cutoff point? What is acceptable? What's not acceptable?
If I can add to that, the planning portion of the road standards are how many lots will the road serve, and then how do we split them into particular categories. The details and design standards on those particular categories, that's in the engineering standards.
Mr. Ockington, back there, could you kind of share with us where you're at with this process?
I'm just taking it all in right now.
So I'm not sure if this is the right time to make this comment. As I was going over this, it occurred to me that I'm not sure that even the number of houses on a road is actually the best way to determine the main concern seems to be fire trucks getting in and out of the emergency. And the longer the road is, then the more trouble it is, regardless of how many houses are on. If there are five houses on a 10-mile road, that seems like that would still be a problem, more of a problem than perhaps on a short road. So would it be possible, I mean, talk about distances and things, but it's possible to say that the last, I don't know, thousands, and I'm just putting a number, that instead of saying if you have more than X number of houses, then you have to have a two-lane road, how about saying if the road is longer than X distance, then it's got to be two lanes up until the point where there's only, 1,000 feet or 5 miles or something like that. What I'm saying is that does it make more, because obviously the front part of a road from the entrance to the main roadway gets a lot more traffic than the very end of the road, when you get down to 2, 3, 2, 1 house, and the first part of the road may have 10 houses traveling. So would it make sense to have some point at which we say, okay, it's going to be two lanes up to this point and then beyond that? We could have standards based on it.
The way most standards are written for roads are based on use. And that's usually you don't change a road partway through. I mean, it'd be like having Foothill being as wide as it is, and then you get halfway to Jackson County, and we make it narrow just because there's only a few Josephine County residents.
Well, there are roads. You get out in the county and you go on a road, and there'll be some point in which the road, and maybe it's the part where it's no longer trying to change something, but the road gets narrower.
That's typically what it is. It goes from a maintained road to a non-maintained road.
And I'm not making a proposal. I'm just trying to think out of the box and think, is the way that we're doing this, does it really make the most sense, or are there other ways of approaching it?
Either or standard, 5 lots or 1,000 feet, whichever comes first, then the road standard changes to something.
Yeah,
then you're dealing with the steepness of the property. The visual line of sight, turnouts. That was the problem we were having when we were going over this in the meeting a few weeks
ago. If you get away from the number of lots criteria, the number of lots determines the traffic on the road. It's not the distance from
Right, but if you get to past the first, you know, let's say you have 10 houses on the road, and you get past the first 5 houses, well, now you've only got 5 houses worth of traffic using the rest of that road, not 10. I actually did make that proposal.
Yeah, I think it's a good one still. But your question now is, should we be hammering this all out now, or should we just take it to the public hearing? And I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
Because there's more demand on the first part of the road than there is on the latter part.
Right.
It is, you know, do you save money by, or do you say, we don't have to put all of that at the end of the road.
Right.
We have to put it up the front part.
We
design something that comes in between that. And that's what is, I looked at your recommendations that LDAC had made, and it just wasn't in there quite like that. We discussed that. What happens when, you know, you have X amount of land, somebody subdivides up there, and all of a sudden it changes the equation. What is the instrument that you're going to use to widen that road before you grant that building?
And the other questions, if I had been on LDAC at the time that the, you know, the roads thing came up, that would have been the perfect place to raise them, but I wasn't in that fundraising plan.
Those issues were the road department came back and said, the roads subcommittee.
It's not an easy question. There's too many variables in it. That's what we need to be.
Right.
Is
and
the variables what
are
we do make it there?
I tend to be against one size fits all.
Well, there isn't one size that really fits all, but most of these things do that.
But your solution actually is still a one size fits all. Because once you get to 5 lots at the end, it goes to that standard. So you are kind of still staying one size still fits all.
Yeah, but you still have different sizes at the beginning of the road that you use for. And I'm just thinking in terms of, you know, I'm trying to look at the priorities that the different stakeholders have here. And, you know, some of the stakeholders, the people who want to develop a road and want less expenses, they don't want 2 lanes for the whole thing. But then on the other hand, in terms of the fire safety, you don't want to have, you want to have sufficient width to pass and perhaps lane. And so you have these standards, and I'm thinking, well, is there a way to take the highest priority of each stakeholder and find a solution that meets both of them? But it seems like there could be other ways of approaching it that might satisfy the highest priority of the stakeholder. Just tossing that out in the air, and maybe it isn't the right time of time to do that.
It's not that I'm disagreeing with you, I've just never seen it.
I think topography, case by case, is going to be different every case. There's no more flat pieces of ground out there. What you're talking about, everybody visualizes on a flat piece of land, but the reality is we don't see those subdivisions, and those have all been built out. So we're all in tough, steep slope stuff now. So I think topography is going to dictate a lot of stuff too that needs to be brought into
this. Part of what we brought with us tonight, the staff prepared to sort of visually represent what it is that we're dealing with. We brought a few examples of roads in the county, what they look like on the ground. We overlaid the land divisions with topography. And then one where we've got one that's side by side with another piece of property. They're almost identical, but the topography is different. So when you look at it just on a site plan or subdivision map, it's going to look like, oh, fine, you could do what you did next door. Well, the topography is going to be different. And I think just visually, to represent these things and look at maps and see it in front of us and then take these standards and apply. That'll be a good exercise to do tonight. And again, that's just to flush out people's thinking on this. So Chuck, you probably have more at Public Works standpoint of Don asked for.
Yeah, you know, basically, you know, if it's a public road, it's going to have to be asked to. And on a private, my recommendation would be to meet fire code standards. Just for public safety and liability.
The fire code standards, I know that when you go to get your homeowner's insurance, they ask you, you know, what's the distance to a fire hydrant and or the nearest fire station.
It's an ISO rating that they rate you on.
clear. I guess there isn't really, I don't recall anything in there where they actually, there's anything about roads or things of roads or anything.
I've never been asked to be, I've been very much on the I just say you're within 5 miles of that.
Right. What fire station, and then fire hydrant is the second thing.
What's your rationale for the fire standard? I mean, is it just for fire protection, or is it because that's a national standard that we can point to?
Well, it's
pretty much the same.
It's for
most
both.
Engineers know what that is. So.
Yeah, it's really for both. It's, you know, fire departments know what they need to get their pieces of the equipment in, and it's always not, like, it won't be always, you know, Gould that shows up. It could be Medford, or it could be, you know, Roseburg that shows up for the fire. The Vista fire is a great example. We have people from Washington coming in and people from California. And basically, you know, if you apply their standards on the private roads and driveways, you can guarantee, basically, that the fire departments will get permission. And it's you know, safety thing. You know, it's like, you know, if you're driving around, you know the yellow line's always on the left side of your car. But if you go to Canada, I mean, that's true, but they have other things that are different in their regulations. So, you know.
But how big of a fire truck can you design around? They have to bring a hooking ladder out the house fire up.
Well, I hope they don't.
I'm just saying, that's a question that you have to look at.
And that's something the fire department looks at, I presume. I mean, I'm not a fire expert on trucks, so.
I think our last session here, we talked about that, where Illinois' fire department uses a tender, the 48,000, 50,000
pound tenders. Yeah, but if Eureka came up, Firewire, Cape Junction, or Crescent City, what kind of vehicles do they have?
Well, I'm just using what is in service already in part of the Illinois history. And you have what I call the 1 tons that have 500 gallon tanks on the tender. If they can't get up the road, they have to come back and they get water. If you get the tender up through the fire, you're going to have much more success. I'm trying to balance that out. That's the worst scenario that I know as far as the large piece of equipment that might blow up.
Although, you know, we do have this at fire game, we have, you know, V8. Trailers with meats going up.
Mm-hmm. So, I hate to think I was engineering a road for a D8 to get up on a truck and trailer there. It's almost impossible on some of these.
I don't disagree. I'm just,
yeah, I know. There's all these scenarios out there. You know, we'd like to engineer it, but we have to be reasonable cost-wise.
Oh, I understand, but, you know, you don't design for the smallest vehicle.
No, that's what I'm saying. This is what we have out here. This is kind of the middle of the road as far as...
So how long should these design standards be valid for? When trucks change, I mean, they may get smaller, they may get bigger. And what are we looking at?
Well, to get the next size bigger, we'd have another drop axle on it. And they have a drop axle on the back. They got bigger, so the footprint wouldn't change a whole lot from what it was. It just dispersed the load on more axles. They're always coming up with something bigger.
Oh, yeah.
So.
Some smaller, some bigger.
Yeah.
All I'm saying is, when you do a standard, you need to be careful to incorporate anything reasonable in size in the foreseeable future, because the road will be there long after we're done.
I'm not sure whether this is for Chuck or whoever, but you suggested that the private roads be fire code standards. Is there, I mean, maybe I have it, but I don't know what I'm looking at. Is there a standard already published?
It's in the fire code, obviously.
It's in the national fire code?
Yeah.
Okay. So that would be your recommendation for private road standards?
That would be my recommendation.
Okay. And we could probably look that up somewhere if we wanted to see what it was.
I've never seen that either, but that would be interesting.
We can get that from you or from
Charlie. Charlie would be the best.
Okay.
It's been a few years since I've gotten here, so
we'll pull the fire code standard and email that to the planning commission. So you can always see
maybe that is.
Well, that's be a print.
Yeah.
My three pages.
Well, look for a graphic. How's that? A picture. I would have a picture. Yeah. A picture worth a thousand words.
One of the questions I wanted to pose to Chuck was that you had mentioned at one point that having a restricted residential standard and a private road standard makes things a little confusing engineering-wise.
It does because they serve the same function, and the private road actually covers more. So my thought is, why would anybody ever build a restricted residential road if they could build a private road? Less money, serves more lots, more flexibility.
Its access is prohibited.
If you can gate it, something to toss out there to everybody.
And why do we need two standards? I always have to look this up again because I can never remember what the differences are.
Restricted residential road is a public road that is privately maintained.
Okay.
It's the biggest,
and it serves up to 5 lots.
And it serves up to 5 lots. The LDAC proposal is to go to 10 lots. It would still have that public access easement over it. It would be privately maintained.
And a private road is just easements on private property.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily.
Well, the easement part can be controlled.
That's one of the questions. That's one of the questions.
Owned by everybody along the road.
One of the questions that planning had about the standards, and it's buried in this bigger portion of the agenda, sorry for that, is whether the road should be an easement or a tract, because the LDAC proposal doesn't specify which. And maybe it could be either, and if the planning commission is comfortable with that, that's fine, but easements are a different animal than a tract.
Right, and I recall there was some discussion that, you know, whereas an easement, that's for the beginning. To property disputes, and somebody saying, well, it's my land, and somebody saying, well, I've got a right to trade it on.
Right.
Whereas if it's a tract, then everybody agrees with it.
Tracts are usually surveyed, pins are in the ground. They're a piece of land that is in joint ownership. What can change about that is if a private road belongs to, say, 5 property owners or 6 property owners, that tract then has perhaps an LLC that owns the tract. If you add on to that private road, you'd have to have an allowance for more people to join the tract and then extend the tract in the next plat. Those are issues to think about, how this is going to look on the ground.
And that does seem to make sense, that would be
typically in plan unit developments, you'll see the road within a privately owned track. Track A, excuse me, what it's called, or road A. You don't really give it a name at that point. It just identifies the track. So on the plat itself, it will have road identified as road A. That's what everyone's deed will say. And then the official name of the road comes along later and actually files with that road's name.
Track is going to require homeowners association or not necessarily?
Well, one of the distinctions that we made in the staff report as well is the difference between a homeowner's or road maintenance agreement and a homeowner's association that's required of a PUD. There are state statutes that require a homeowner's association for a planned unit development. And what that does is establish an entity, a legal entity that has the financial obligation to take care of anything that that legal entity is in charge of. It could be open space areas, it could be maintenance of certain things, like a gate structure in these real nice subdivisions that have a gate. The homeowners association owns the gate structure. They own the road. And then dues are taken out of your, or dues are charged as assessed.
But that's a little different situation than just, you know, this kind of out in the country, rural road people are living
right.
off it. They're generally not as wealthy.
And the structure of those maintenance agreements is different. And I guess that's part of the point we're making, is that you maybe don't have the assurance that you have through a planned unit development because you have a homeowners association that essentially can't be dissolved in a PUD. You could have a homeowners association that could be dissolved as an agreement for a private landowner. There's no statute requiring.
ones that I could think of.
Kind of morphed into planning.
Yeah.
Anyone have any more questions for Chuck?
Chuck, I think you I had one quick question. You mentioned something about gates on private roads and not. Well, is that true? Because I thought we did a.
There is an exception for restricted residential for the gate, but you have to go through a big process for that.
We should have a staff report, and I apologize for the late date of getting that out. I generally try to do a staff report too, at least a week in advance, and it was a coordinated effort between Public Works and myself. And their comments ended up being the last two pages as an attachment. That's titled Proposed Ordinance Amendments and some of the issues that Chuck just spoke of. And just concerns, remarks, some observations from Public Works. And then as the next attachment was the road standards as for chapters 81, road standards and access standards, and the definition of a private road as proposed by LDAC. But beyond that, you may recall the fourth LDAC recommendation was to a flag lot standard that Michael Snyder had actually written back in October of 2010. And so I added that flag lot standard. That is Article 71.020, extension of public roads and the use of flag lots. So that's the last two pages of the attachment of that staff report. Even though it's written in staff report format, the purpose of this document, and most of it came, frankly, from the comments Mike Snyder had made back in October of 2010. I took that and almost copied it verbatim into this. I wanted to add a few things that I had learned along the way, especially regarding the federal access roads, and to identify, prepare you for the fact that we need to address, this is a legislative text amendment. Several of you have not been through a legislative text amendment before. So to give you a flavor for what that's going to be like, this staff report, at least in structure, is going to look very much like what you'll see when you come to a public hearing. So we have to address the land use state goals, citizen involvement, land use planning, goal 12, which is transportation. Goals of the Josephine County Comprehensive Plan, and I listed three that I think are applicable goals. Oregon Revised Statute 368, which says that the county does have jurisdiction over local access roads and authorizes us to adopt the standards. We always want to know where our authorization comes from.
I assume that means in the unincorporated areas.
Yes.
Okay.
Outside of urban growth now. And I noted there the ORS 368-039, which requires the involvement of fire districts. We've had them in our workshops. That is, in my mind, that satisfied the requirement that they be at the table when we talk about these issues. They'll probably be at your public hearing, but that was something that we needed to make sure that OAR was satisfied.
What page are you on?
Three.
What?
Four axes. And then in the proposed ordinance amendments, we just took them in order. There's some statistical information there on page 4, substantial increase in lots served by private roads, to give you some idea of what the potential is. Most of the subdivisions approved in the last 10 years were for 10 or fewer lots. So as the restricted residential standard went from 5 to 10, Michael's estimation was that most of the subdivisions you see will have restricted residential road. As Chuck just pointed out, if you're balancing a private road versus a restricted residential, you may end up with strictly private roads.
Or we could choose to approve 10 lots or more restricted residential private roads.
Correct.
And there's some reason to maybe go that way. We talked about fire safety consequences extensively in some of the workshops. And then moving on to page five. We just wanted to point out that essentially what the gist of what LDAC has proposed is a policy shift from public roads to private roads, private responsibilities for maintenance, taking some of the burden off public works. However, with that, we have many more parties at the table. So those are some of the issues that we pointed out in the following pages. And I noted halfway through page five, Chuck's observation that having two kinds of privately maintained roads they function the same, they have separate standards, perhaps that isn't necessary. There were some more observations that Michael had made about the provision of private roads that I included in the staff report.
Can I have a quick question to Malcolm, because he was there at the time?
Sure.
Was the reason for extending it to 10 on the number, was that just in case one didn't pass, the other would cover it, or
I'm not really sure why.
Do you remember?
No,
I had disagreements with him on that
point.
He never got a good answer.
I know part of the reasoning behind the extending the residential would be that a lot of the other counties were
private with 10 lots also, they're that much distinct.
We do have a chance now to ferret that out of this December agreement. This is a choice. We can make it simpler if we go private and restrict this type of
thing. I'd just point out, too, if we were to propose private roads and put standards on them, like Nancy Pittman's WD type. On the highway, we don't do anything with restricted residential. Residential, we don't have to go through that stuff, and it's going to end up with less road maintenance that way on restricted residential than on the private. Real mishmash of possibilities.
Well, there could be different types of private roads and the county unmaintained road, and trying to get people to maintain them. There will always be somebody that will put in their fair share. I put in $20 last year, I'm not putting another dime into this, type of attitude. And there we have a nasty road, which means everybody's property values go down. Live there and put up with this type of thing. They'd rather have the paved access road. And also that somebody developed a gravel road, another developer has a paved road, property is going to sell. Is it going to be the guy that 10 acres for, say, $100,000, then I got to pay $150,000 over here if it's paid? Decisions. I know where I live right now, I'm on County Cane Road, and we paid $78,000 in paving because the dust was not bearable.
Yeah, I'm going to think about the same thing.
County unmaintained road?
Is that
the thing
restricted
residential? No, it belongs to the county, but they don't maintain it.
But no, that is a restricted residential.
That is
not.
Yeah, it just doesn't work really well. That's where you have. If we had a maintenance agreement on those roads, you would have something. But,
the new ones all do have maintenance agreements, but they're not. Reasonably, of course, you've got to make somebody a court, and you can do that over a couple hundred bucks.
In private road networks, that's something that we saw an issue rather than just focusing on a particular road or a single road, there would be no restriction to bringing a private road off another private road off another private road. And while that may not be entirely likely to happen. There is no restriction against that in the LDAC proposal as stated. And if you have different road maintenance agreements, if the first road off of the public road takes most of the abuse, and those people are paying for the maintenance on that, and another private road comes off, let's say a developer owns three large parcels in a row, develops the first one as a road maintenance agreement, then develops the second as a road maintenance agreement between those folks, what's the legal obligation that the two road maintenance agreements be pulled together? There really is none.
Now, when we have a public hearing, will we at that time, we will have the ability to decide if we want to make amendments and say that, you know, we can't have private roads off of the private roads, we can only have them off of.
In a public hearing with this particular standards or with each development?
Yeah, no, in the public hearing when we discuss the standards, will that be, at that point, can we say, well, we want to amend this standard before we're adopting it? Or is it just
can we hold that thought? We'll talk about amending standards later.
I mean, amending the proposal. Is saying at that time, we want to approve the proposal, but not exactly as written. We want to change it.
I think she said we have to deal with these recommendations. Yes or no, and ours are gray area.
I think my recommendation at this point is to not change the recommendations, take them to a public hearing, get the public's input, and at that time when the Planning Commission hears all the information you've heard from the fire district, you've heard from Jeff, then it's time to contemplate what change. What do you want to keep?
That's what I'm saying.
That was the idea of bringing it to a public hearing. You may have been kind of shocked when I said that, but we figured we could fix that at that point. But to keep the LDAC proposal as pure as possible, we bring them forth, and then we will say, well, this needs to be taken into consideration and go for a
while. And then riddled through the staff report are obviously some recommendations on things that I think might work better or things that I didn't think would work that well. But my intention would be that the LDAC proposal goes to a public hearing in fact.
You've been sharing yours in some kind of color code so we know what you put in here? Or there's no way we can find that. That's what we thought would work.
They're in there in the back.
Say they're underlined.
The LDAC proposal? Oh. Yeah.
I'm talking about what you put in.
Yeah, right.
It's right here. So it's not buried in here, it's in the back.
I haven't changed it. Yeah, I haven't changed a word of their proposal at all. In the staff report are recommendations, but they're within the text.
I have a clarification or a question. I'm not sure which, but you said that they can have private roads come off private roads. The first page of their proposal, it says they have to be in occupied connection. So that's not in the part, I guess, back here at the Los Angeles on private road. I don't know what's in there. I assumed it was, right?
In the recommendations, what portion?
Well, where I'm seeing that is on page one of proposed changes to the road second paragraph, four, nine, from the bottom of the second paragraph.
The road circulation system is internal to the project, does not provide a through connection where none is planned or practical.
I can tell you what the thinking was behind that part of the LDAC recommendation was they didn't want to open it up to everybody being able to pull private roads off the private roads, not in subdivisions. You have private roads going through there, you can't go out the other side of another public road. So I think there are some restrictions on
with those. Well, we weren't sure.
You could have a whole network of
yeah, as long as it's all happening off. Technically, the way they wrote it was not going to be coming off one road. Now, that is the problem. What do you do for a loop road? You have to
deal with it. Well, that was when Bob was here last, it wasn't clear. Mr. Hart was here. There was talk about being able to extend it to other divisions, and then the discussion about a loop road came up, and then it was talked about, well, no, that it wouldn't be connecting roads. So, as planning, looking at this, trying to bring it forward, we're not sure. And if you look further in the LDAC recommendations, I think it's page 5 or 7, 83, 300F, it actually talks about single lane private road intersects a public road or other approved private roads. So we're not sure if we're saying these can.
F?
Page 5F.
So we're just trying to get clarification. Are we talking connect or they don't connect? Individual development only or network?
The recommendation says that there is no connection, and yet the code language says there is.
Exactly.
Well, I think what they're saying is no site connection. Obviously,
the other thing you
would have to put up in a
private road.
So I think we're just looking for clarification if that's the route it's going. I don't know, honestly, what the recommendations of this. It was hard to say no, but yes at other times. So, and this isn't clear either to me.
Well, no, in discussion, and I don't think this got into the proposal, but the discussion, we thought it would be a good idea to clarify. You've got a private road system, if you're ever going to extend it to another road system, you've got to make the whole thing public where it's, up to the extension.
Well,
where it meets another public road system?
Right. Or whether it provides access to a road beyond
it. Right. So you've got to bring the original road up to public road standards and make a public road up. But that didn't get into your proposal.
Okay. But then you're requiring the dedication of all those property owners who access their private road and to extend it to another property or expand it, everyone has to dedicate their portion of the road, correct? Right?
Well, then if they don't, you can't do it. You're right.
Ron, that's what I'm reading, because it gets you into a nasty catch 22. Because if you go to page 5F and it says you have to increase the 22 feet, you're going to have that, whether it's deeded or easement, initially on the first build out. Because you're not going to be able to expand it after the fact. So that's going to set your road width on design.
You can't expand it, it's just difficult to do so.
Yeah, you're going to have to do it up front.
Okay. This was
okay. Getting back to one of my pet peeves, and I think I said this at an earlier workshop, but I'm still concerned about the total lack of what I call a master plan grid system for the county. And where I have been previously, there I've looked at maps that lay out future collector streets on a grid that don't exist, or nor do they even have the right-of-way for. But somebody bothered to put them on a map and say, yeah, this would be a nice place to have a collector street, or, you know, and is there such a document in this county?
It is. Transportation system.
Master plan or something like that?
There is now.
So what would happen is that they would use that master plan whenever subdivision came up for approval through the planning department, or they would say, okay, how does this subdivision fit into that collector street master plan of a grid? Because I will have to say that since moving here 4 years ago, I've never seen a worse situation of a street that just seemed to go nowhere. They, you know,
why they call it rural.
I guess it's rural, but you know, I've been in other rural places.
You need to drive Medford, and then you'll have a better understanding.
Yeah, I don't know, but anyway, that's what I'm getting at. That's my pet peeve, is the lack of, whether it's public or private, look, I see a lack of master plans for a grid system that makes sense.
It doesn't make sense. I mean, it's got to make sense. We have very little developable property that's in this county, really, when you figure that so much of it is under a government entity. And
sure.
It's steep.
Sure.
So it's hard to just lay a grid over something and say, this is it.
Just about collector streets, I think, are important to have a master plan of that so that everything is done with some thought to it in the long range.
One of the issues you may recall in the last meeting we had in this room was I was having a conversation with Mr. Hart about requiring that a circulation plan come in with any subdivision to show how it does connect with other roads in the area or could potentially connect with other roads or properties that are large enough and yet zoned densely enough that they can further divide. And that gives you a sense of what kind of future connections or steps you might want to require. Most jurisdictions do require a road circulation plan as part of the subdivision proposal to show where it fits in the larger network. That isn't part of this particular proposal, but that's something to think about.
While we're on this subject of the extending of the private roads, one of the documents that we gave you, I think it kind of illustrates kind of where
we're looking at is just the black and white single page one. You can see a series of cul-de-sac bulbs that over time go south to north on the kind of the middle of the page there. See the one we're talking about?
Yeah. See this? Okay. Yeah. Doesn't have one there. This year.
What does that look like?
That is, I think it's Wildwood Drive. Hugo Rose. Here's is the railroad tracks. It predates me. Anyways, that was
like Hugo. Looks like it's 12 miles south.
Nope, that's Hugo. That's the Falcon Ridge subdivision, kind of the left hand side there. Anyways, that was just to illustrate kind of the stacking, if you will, private roads and private roads. Now that obviously is a public road, and you can see that it's got a uniform width that it's just extended each time. But that was kind of one of our concerns with the way the code is written here. Is that what we're talking about, being able to stack on private roads and having situations like this? Probably talking about different widths constantly. Anyway, that was just one of the handouts. I wanted to point that out. It kind of illustrates.
So your point here is that I can't tell how wide this road is. Is it a single lane road or?
Well, that's a county road. So it's a
county road. Okay.
Two lane. I think it's probably a 60 or 50 foot standard width. But if you had private roads, essentially you can see the first one, this was the first development at the bottom here. And then the next guy developed and brought it up here, called the second, and so on and so on. So we're just looking for clarification on the private road's abilities to do that or not do that. This is just kind of a visual effect of what we're talking about could happen. And of course, if we're talking private roads, then as discussed previously, getting everybody downstream, so to speak, to agree to new guys coming in, revising maintenance agreements every time. We're talking about more process and heartache, actually.
Okay, back to the staff report. Take you back to that. Get through planning's comments, and then we're going to get on to some more examples.
Okay, Joanna.
8.
Which
in the middle of the page, one of the observations that we had of the LDAC proposal was that if private road standards are adopted, then some of the specific requirements listed in 81.300 specifically in subsection G, those would be eliminated. If we go to a private road standard, the county doesn't have a dog in the fight. So reference to any property owner, road maintenance agreement shall be enforceable by a property owner obligated under the agreement and by Josephine County. No, the county would not be enforcing that obligation. Road maintenance shall be performed whenever deterioration results in exposure of the subgrade, failure of the foundation, erosion of ditches or road shoulders. It's up to the property owners to figure out when that happens. With veto and county oversight for that. There was also a requirement that the loading standards of bridges be inspected every 10 years, certificate be furnished to the party and to the Director of Public Works. Bob isn't going to review it. It's not his road. So when we're thinking about private roads, it's kind of like you're all in or you're all out. And I just want to remind the Planning Commission that when we do, if it's decided that a private road standard goes in, think about the parameters and the restrictions that the jurisdiction would have on that. Not going to involve the county expense or jurisdiction or oversight on a public road.
And on a restricted residential road, some people can't
agree on maintaining it, then the county can certainly make it available.
Could potentially do so, yes, and because it's a public access.
Right, right. And, if there's a bridge or something, the same thing happens if the people do not.
Rob, you have the jurisdiction.
We do. Yeah, we've never gotten to that point with the bridge for sure. And I could have been last.
We did clear.
There you go.
Well, again, one of the sort of highlights, one of the differences between a restricted residential road and a purely private road. The public access easement over the road, Public Works does have the ability to go in there and fix a bridge, repair a blowout of the road, that sort of thing. The private road would be up to the private owner.
I would hope that Public Works would be able to build the property owner to the proximity of non-maintained road like a restricted road. I'm going to call you guys next time I get in a fight.
It depends what the commissioner's on.
That's, yeah. Pardon me?
Depends what the commissioner's directed on.
Oh, but
We would probably try, the commissioners might just say, no, you're going to wait it. That's not just what happened. Unless it was some exorbitant amount where, if it was a real big deal. But if it was anything less, I'd pick a number 5,000. I could easily see the commissioner saying, no, that's Public Works is anything.
Now, the last one that failed was Tremel, and we did not get involved in that. Commissioners, Tremel, dipped out off by Lake Zemeck, and commissioners told Procter they had to deal with it.
But you guys said Dirt Creek and county expensive.
I wasn't here, so I don't know if we
paid for it. That's what they said in the paper. But I think that was a $3,000 project.
Yeah,
four direction.
Now, the other thing is if your bridge is over 20 feet in length on a restricted residential road, ODOT expects it. It's no cost.
How long? What was the length?
It has to be 20 feet clear.
Do they have any jurisdiction over it? 20 foot long, besides inspecting it?
They inspect it and they can direct the county to close it.
If it's a restricted residence?
It's a restricted residence because it's in a public right of way.
And if it were on private land, they would not inspect it.
They have no jurisdiction.
Planning mistake on this was, it's a good idea to require some sort of agreement to lay out the private responsibilities for private roads, but the county is a public agency, not part of the agreement. And with fire districts and individual fire providers, obviously, it's unclear to us how that relationship takes place. If people on a road that have different fire providers according to their private service contracts, and yet which fire company inspects the road, if any? So that's an unknown. That's part of the private road equation.
And on a restricted residential road, it's inspected by the county.
Okay.
Wait, what's
inspected by the county?
Restricted residential roads. As they're being constructed.
Oh, when it's constructed, right, but not later. Why not?
So if there's a bridge on a restricted residential road, does that get bit less than
it just depends. Depends on the width of the channel and the waves. Yeah. I try to do culverts if I could. We have probably 15 or 20 bridges that are less than 20 feet.
Moving on to page 9 of the staff report, we had modifications of access standards to include special forest access roads. And there was some discussion in the last hearing when we talked about different lot sizes that might be allowed or not on those roads. And I cited an ORS and an OAR here in the staff report on page 9. Essentially for new tracts zoned forest, they can be 160 acres in size and be served by these roads. Otherwise, BLM road cannot serve tracks that are under that in the forest zones. And a U.S. Forest Service road has to be paved to a minimum width of 18 feet. So 160 acres, I believe Mr. Hardhead referenced that last time he spoke, that would happen for new land divisions. That are zoned forest, on forest zone lands. But we do have some BLM and Forest Service roads that go through our RR5 zones, and those are ones where we can have individual 5-acre or 10-acre parcels be divided on a BLM or Forest Service road that's not zoned forest. There's additional information on page 10 and 11 about the approval process, BLM versus Forest Service. They have two different ways of doing that. One of the questions we have, and frankly I don't have an answer to it, is BLM writes contracts with individuals, and they establish a 30-year grant. They do that within the individuals, so if you're a developer coming in and you want to write that contract with BLM for access to the road, once you divide the property, the way I read it is that each individual property owner would then have to establish their own agreement with BLM. And how that gets transmitted in a plat or to property owners and their deeds remains to be seen. I think that would probably be a condition on the facing the plat. But we're requiring a contract with another federal agency, and I'm not sure what the final outcome would be. Yes.
I thought that some of us that are previous workshop on this, that other counties do allow that or don't prohibit that. Am I remembering that correctly? Is that anybody involved?
And we had to about Jackson County.
Jackson County, yes.
So would it make sense to find out if they've had any issues with that or if that's something?
We're asking them.
Okay.
Yeah. We've got a couple of phone calls into Jackson County.
Yep. It would seem pretty stupid. It would seem unwise for a developer to go in from the trouble to do a subdivision and not have something in terms of BLM that is going to be able to sell a lot. I can't see that happening. I also think it would be pretty cool if there's something to buy a lot and have to go, oh, now I got to go deal with BLM.
I would think they'd have to establish that contract before they
subdivide it.
Well, before they actually buy the property. I don't think BLM necessarily guarantees access for any future owner because they only do it with an individual. That's the point.
We have seen people buy property since I've been around, but that has happened.
Yeah.
Dan and I talked about this today, and I felt that this is not our fight. We shouldn't be in the middle. We shouldn't be restricting development. Because there's got to be left. We need to absolve ourselves of liability and have a sign-off that when they go in there and they do this, that they understand the ramifications of dealing with BLM or forestry department. Things can change. You may be getting to your property by helicopter, especially if the road washes out and they say they're not maintaining that anymore. So.
Hey, a retired district ranger that if there is private property that they have to allow access to it one way or another, but that they can you know, they don't have to do any maintenance on it. They can charge you, they can rent you, I mean they charge you, it's kind of like rent, I don't know what they call it, but just the right to go through the property, and that they but that, you know, they can shut anything at any time and it's really fine for all maintenance. We do maintenance
and
up to their standards. So,
and that's what we were talking about, that has to be in this sign off.
Right.
Just that everybody knows that this is the weak link. I have not bought property because of that weak link, and I just couldn't handle what if that road washed out, the cost of what it would be to replace it.
Of course, different people have different houses or things like that.
Finally, on page 11, we address the expanded use of flag lot design, and that flag lot standard is the final attachment to the staff report, and it shows code language as it would be written in the current code. Mike Snyder had written this up. Starts on Exhibit C, page 7-4, and portion that is proposed by LDAC be included starts at section 71.020, extension of public roads and the use of flag lots. One of the observations that I make in the staff report is that we also have a portion of the code that requires a 25-foot wide connection to a public road. We have to change that up. We're going to allow private roads, obviously. But requires a 25-foot connection to a public road. And so if you had two flag lots side by side, the section that Mr. Snyder wrote would allow the road to be within that, two side by side, within that 50-foot section. One of the things that I've noticed over the years of looking at subdivision plats is that that driveway is going to be shared. It's going to be about 12 feet wide. There might be a couple of feet of gravel on either side of it. If you take 50 feet, take out the 12 feet, you've got a whole lot left over. Nobody maintains. So one of the things that I would offer to the Planning Commission is to consider each leg actually be less than 25 feet apiece. It would be 25 feet total. 12 to 15. Then you've got a 5-foot strip on either side. It's much less to maintain. And so I think if you're going to go to flag lots, we're assuming there's a shared driveway. Let's not make that driveway requirement any more for the two lots than we would for a single lot.
Double fire access.
Might depend. That might be dependent upon the length of the flag lot
and how steep it is.
Yeah.
And many.
Right. And you're for these particular lots here, then you'd have more room available for them. Let's say we've got a county road down here. We're accessing. They pick up a little more property there. Something.
That'd be a silly
question. I've just found a lot of flag lots. There seems to be extra ground. Nobody likes to mow. And you've got to, you know, put your mower 300 feet down the driveway.
Are flag lots always straight?
No.
That's what
he's
saying. Anyway, that pretty much concludes our comments on the LDAC standards. We wanted to point out some things that we felt were missing, a different perspective on a few items, things where we felt there might be some conflict between standards, and wanted to give a vehicle for getting public works issues on the table as well. For tonight, we also, Roger made a few other copies that I think have been distributed of some maps to kind of walk through what some of these roadways might look like. Walking through that one. There's a green colored one, two right here. Now, this one is actually
be an approved subdivision. I took this to the planning commission 3, maybe 4 years now. It's off of Canal Road near Manson Park. And what is we're illustrating is, as you can see from the hillside relief, this is pretty steep property to begin with. And then when you go to the actual plat map and the lot layout with the topography on there, it's even illustrated even further. And what we have here is the road at the bottom center of the page starts off Fenley Bend Drive. It snakes up into the top and then kind of ends in a cul-de-sac. And you have two separate restricted residential roads. One that goes up to the north, serves 5 lots. The other one heads down south, that's 5 lots. And this is just to illustrate, these are the type of subdivisions we're dealing with now. There is no, everything we're talking about, we're drawing here is on a flat map or flat board, but this is the reality of what we're dealing with out here. It gives you an idea of how these private roads, unmaintained situations could be utilized. And this is all public maintained, public road, restricted residential roads. So that's kind of what we're bringing these things to illustrate to how these are being used or how they are going to be used in the future.
This entire road thing here is again a restricted road.
No. The one that starts at the bottom of this page.
This is a public road.
It's public. They're all public. When you get to the top cul-de-sac up here, it breaks into two restricted residential roads.
Well, the public building. But this is the main road, the Fidley Bend Drive is...
It's a public two-lane, it's there now.
It's the county maintained.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's no different than the county roads you see now.
Roger, I thought that they had an outlet from that.
No, they had a couple ideas in the past. One was to loop it, that Eagle Vista back down and out to it. But
I thought that's what we were approved.
No, that was a previous rendition. This is what you got.
What we got.
And again, just look at the road standards as proposed with this map in your hand, and then think, okay, this road is private. What are some of the issues? What are some of the access maintenance issues that are posed? And how is this going to shake out? Another map that we gave you is, and again, it's a two-parter. The first page looks like this. It's on Columbia Crest Drive.
Paradise Vista.
Paradise Vista.
That same one, space two.
And then just to the east of that will be phase two of Paradise Vista. Flip over the page, and you can see the topographic difference between the two subdivisions. The parcel yet to be developed is much steeper, obviously. The road on that parcel, when the road punches in, will probably not be in a straight line. So that's going to change.
Let's say, like, excavating a lot.
And the road maintenance costs of the road on the left are going to be a lot cheaper than the road on the right.
What is 5 acres?
It's not 5 acres.
Five acre lots. There are 16
lots.
Okay. That are served by the road. The road is approximately 2,300 feet in length. And I noticed per the road standards as proposed, one of the questions I had was based on. I won't make you go through it, but I'll read it out loud. It says, for private road standard, it serves more than 10 lots or parcels, the road width shall have a minimum driving surface of 20 feet. If you come in with a whole subdivision and you're more than 10 lots, I read that to mean it's your 20-foot driving surface all the way from where the road starts to the end. If you did that in a couple of phases, and you put your first phase in, and you're less than 10 lots, now do you double the road width and make it a driving surface of 20 feet once you get over the 10 lots? Or does the whole road now have to meet that standard, or what?
Yeah,
there are questions about developing in phases, and when you're, again, hooking on more lots into a road, if you have a standard that says we have to have this number of lots,
generally speaking, roads get bigger, but within public right-of-way when you have it dedicated already. You get that dedication right up front because you know what the classification of the road will be and how many lots it will serve.
Is this a PUD?
No.
Neither of these two that I'm showing.
But you know that they're going to phase one and phase two, and they told you that already, right?
Right.
So then the wider road would apply.
Did they still the ultimate build out?
Based on the ultimate build out.
Well, these are things we want to get nailed down because I sit in meetings with guys that just tear apart the code to say, well, no, it doesn't read that way. We can do it this way, we think. And so part of what we're bringing here is we're looking to get clarification. Let's shore up some things so that we can use this document.
And, well, I think if they build out the first five and then there's a possibility they may someday build out the other five, the other 10, you would think you would require up front that it be.
But if the code says, if it's only over 10 do I require a double lane road, then can't require it until we get to that 10 number. So I'm saying, in looking at these practical applications, do we look at it, if you're going to stub it, and it potentially could serve more than 10, simply by looking at the parcels that we hook into it, do we charge, or do we require a double lane road?
Or you tell them that the first they must leave an easement on the first section on both sides of the road, and then if they do build out the rest of it, then it becomes wider.
Awesome. Yeah, it seems that it would be in the developer's best interest to leave that right-of-way wide enough if they intend to ever develop it beyond that, because otherwise they're stuck.
It may not be done.
But if they don't do it, then they're just stuck because they don't have enough right-of-way to widen the road enough to do it.
You just kind of a little different angle on that. It's much cheaper for a developer to go in there and do this now, rather than pay for the mobilization of equipment to go out there again and do the paving. You know, paving's not getting cheaper, it's getting more expensive by the day. So if I was a contractor or the developer on there, I would punch that road all the way through and get my commitment spent, because I know I'm going to have a much better chance of selling it rather than going into some of these phase one, phase two, phase three.
Yes, that developer may not have your mindset. Why do they say, let's leave
I'm just from a professional view. Yeah. I just want you to know there's mobilization involved, which you don't most probably haven't had the chance to do something like this, and you have. That's why the theory of partly what you were doing was a little skewed on point mobilization and cost. As another contractor over here can tell you.
I just want to point out, those of you that don't know it, the current standard for restricted residential are, if there's no possibility of extending the road past five lots, one lane's five, one lane substructure. If there's a possibility to go farther than that, you have to build it two lanes wide. You don't have to pave it two lanes wide. You have to have it cut open. You have to have easement by it. I would personally not favor going to 10 lots on a single lane road. I would say after five lots, you got to have two lanes. That's my preference.
Put it in.
Yeah. And it's not that much more money necessarily to make the base wider.
Remember the old deal, paving now, paving later, but you're not paving.
Yeah.
Well, that's going to pay.
I'd say we're all the way back to the first two meetings of the LDAC, as you remember, Gordon Longhurst, number one complaint was that sixth lot is the backbreaker. He had three different examples. It's like deja vu. That was his primary complaint. I don't know where you were there, a couple of years ago, Margaret made that. That was his very first and biggest complaint, was that he had a specific development. That sixth lot was going to be, you know, $120,000 of improvements for a $60,000 lot, verbatim.
Yeah. And what Don pointed out is a good point. If you're looking at that whole parcel and you own a 16.5 90 acres. If you own the whole parcel, and as Don said, you don't want to mobilize your equipment twice, and you want to make that road all the way through, even though you may not divide the lots right away, you might phase the development so you're not dividing up the property, paying more taxes, and that sort of thing. That's fine. But if your whole stack comes down like this, here's your subdivision. That's all you own. Owner one. So now, haven't built the whole road. We're not at 10 lots yet. Now, we've got owner number two. And we've got owner currently served by private access easements that are 15 feet wide.
Full access easements, pretty common in the county.
So now this guy comes through, maybe does a like a temporary turnaround at the end of his road or something. We're not at 10 yet, let's say. Maybe we are at this point. So his question is going to be, he now trips the 10th lot, as Rob was saying. Does he build a double line road? Or what about getting into this one? Now you've got people here. Maybe we've got a house here. We've got a house here. We've got the developer still owning these two lots, and we've got a house under construction. And now this road has to be paved, or widened to two lanes to now serve lots 7, 8, 9, 10, 11.
And that was actually under the proposal that I was suggesting earlier, be even worse, because then if only the first part then had to be widened, if the second part didn't, then the people who owned the first part would have said, why do I have to widen my road because you're building extra property?
So when you look at maps, try to think of it not only in its total final form, but what about if you had different property owners that owned different pieces of it? Phasing works just fine if you have to be the one doing all the phases, but if someone else is doing the property and owns it, that can matter. Another thing I wanted to use with this as an example is the road maintenance agreement. We assume that all 16 owners are going to own 1/16 of the road. Not necessarily. Property sells pretty slowly these days. So you may, as a developer, divide all 16 parcels, but you only have 5 different owners. And you as the developer own 8 parcels, let's say. Now the road wipes out. And now you have to pay 8 shares. Go back in, one individual gets a larger proportionate share of the road fix. And another scenario is the road blows out here. Question mark. Is he okay for that? Now, if he's obligated by a good road maintenance agreement, he is obligated. Now, whether the owner of lot number 10, who needs that roadway to get to his house, enforce the rest of the pin for it is the question.
Question: how much it costs to fix it, or is worth going after it?
What are the legal mechanisms and stuff? And I guess I raised that point because if somebody owns 4 or 5 of those lots, and this guy finds that it's necessary to do that, then you've got one owner who is taking a greater proportion of burden. Now, could he build that additional road cost into maybe the sale of those lots eventually? Yes, he could. There are other ways of offsetting that cost. But those are the kind of situations we see with privately maintained roadways and multiple owners. And again, I raised that just to point out, don't assume that it's always hit, the pie is going to be divided evenly. That isn't always the case.
Just again, I want to ask you, if this is a restricted residential road, then what happens? Does the if lot number 10 can't get lot number 1 through 9 to pay up for that, then does the county come in and fix it? And that's then.
Wouldn't be my first choice. Yeah, we just down blank on those, because as soon as we start arbitrating one, pretty simple to parking police, literally, and maybe calls on so-and-so park in the middle of the restricted.
My favorite one on restricted is this guy called up and said, my neighbor's stealing dirt from the road. He's cleaning the disc, what he's doing.
So yeah, I'm just trying to figure how much different this would be on a private road than it would be on a restricted residential road. What would be the
Well, the current restricted residential roads, we have road maintenance agreements that are signed. So they have a document that's signed.
And the county maintains that road maintenance agreement.
So
we maintain the agreement.
Because it's the clerk's office, or what?
So does it...
I've never heard anything from the county. We don't assume there's payments going in or anything, no.
So you don't enforce it, you just keep a copy of it. It's basically to adjudicate if there's a claim, but they don't have it. It's in the deed on the property. That's recorded. It's a little obvious. But we have the same issue if the road went out just before number 10. 1 through 9 seems to feel like paying something that they weren't
paying.
It sounds like it'd be the same issue.
I think in practice probably would be. And I see your point, Carter. You're saying, you know, if it's private or restricted residential, probably doesn't make any difference. If it's a public road, obviously the road gets fixed. Right. Rob's crews go out and take care of it. I guess what we're saying is that the number of lots. As they increase this kind of problem
more of an issue.
Just compounds. Right. Yes. And if we keep the private roads to maybe five lots or under, as it currently is the restricted residential roads, we've got a smaller road to be dealing with, lower cost potentially if this county needed to step in and fix the road, and frankly, just fewer people involved. Anyway, they're just issues to think about. I've seen these things, you know, happen in subdivisions over here.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out because it feels like it, at some point that it's likely to come down to say, well, these two different kinds of roads are redundant, restricted residential and private, and if it comes down to choosing one or the other, then I'm trying to clearly understand the differences. So
the one difference that just jumps off the
side.
Yeah, it is the length or the number of lots.
Standards.
Yeah.
Versus non-private.
Well, you can establish number of lots, standards for the number of lots on private.
Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely. With the proposal we have in front of us now, there's 10 versus unlimited public access and some mechanism for the county to require a maintenance agreement. Or not.
This is a perfect metaphor. I was coaching my son's second and third grade basketball line. If I got 6 on there, it's easy to get to 9. I called him Watts.
Do you have a maintenance agreement?
Yeah. I'm going to get one of my parents to sign.
Yeah. That's all we got.
Okay. So, 7:30 already. Boy, time goes by fast when you're having fun. Okay, we'd like to move on now to some subcommittee reports. Mr. Wright,
cell tower room final draft should be done shortly. We're expecting one more meeting with the cell tower committee and then hopefully bring it up to public opinion in mid-April is the tentative date. It's not set in stone, but that's where we're at. So we've got some real positive stuff coming forward. As far as I know, the only headache or real drawback we have is going to be the setback distance, and we're going to bring both of those to the Planning Commission and the open review and have a lot of discussion on that.
And the pink people will show up.
Did you
have a question? No, I just made a comment. The pink people will show up.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Okay. When you said you mean a public hearing, you said public review.
We're going to go to public hearing and have an open house or workshop with the public before we bring it in because we want to get more opinion first.
Open house first, like a work session. And then.
I believe that's what we're doing.
Sounds good to me.
That was the original game plan.
Yeah. Your house room.
Hey, I
think if the planning commission thinks that we want to do an open house, talk about the ordinance, that's probably a good idea.
It's best to do that to ferret out a lot of the crap that we won't have to put up at the hearing.
and we do have news people already inquisitive.
Oh.
Any other questions, Mr. Craig? Well, we may be looking at an open house in mid-April rather than a public hearing. But.
Okay. We'll move on to home occupation text amendment. Mr. Rogers.
Okay. So I think we're moving along quite well, actually, with that. We're trying to get a threshold for the type of permits, the levels of permits that home occupancy people are going to need. And we're working on that, and we're working on the fees right now, what we're going to charge and what will actually be the appropriate charge for the different levels. So, and we're working on a list of prohibited and not prohibited businesses that would allow in those zones as well in order to get, you know, the operating homes. So I think we're making some good headway. We've probably got two more meetings left, probably, I would say. We should have a...
You come down to the type one, type two, type three type businesses.
Yeah, and we're going to have one that, we're going to have one may be exempt completely, so we're still working on this.
Would they come in and just file that they're running this business here, but there may not be a fee connected to that?
That, or they might not even have to come in at all. It depends what level.
Do it online or something like that.
And that would be nice. Online, but you know, if you could register online, we're looking at that option as well. So we are trying to bring our county up to the 21st
century. Or considering what 80% of the businesses in the county haven't filed for permits or something like that.
Probably at least.
Is there going to be some grandfather process, or are you going to just go out and say, okay, now you got to file?
I don't think it's really possible to go out and force anybody to do it. I mean, if they're going to do it, if no one knows you're doing it, you know, we're going to make this comfortable so they don't feel threatened that it's going to be a big process and a big dollar fee if they want to do it. I think it's more for new people coming in and new people that are wanting to do things right.
So if you back up right above the
process. Yeah.
It will keep them coming into the... planning office and tell them how much it is, and then they may be here and go.
Well, that's right now. I mean, if they you know, come in at $375 for the pre-app, and it's a $2,000 fee for the next process. I mean, then they just turn around and walk out the door. But if you can do it and say, look, for a $50 fee, you can be a level one. For a $300 or $250 fee, you can be a level two. Yeah. And this is what you have to do. So I think we're making some headway. So it should be attractive when we're done. So.
We've all, that subcommittee is also sort of, in some of the brainstorming we've had in the subcommittee, talked about ways to make businesses more visible. Once they've got their permit, they're legit, you know, put them on the county website, advertise them, promote them, really, really highlight some of those businesses. You know, maybe the county, you know, sponsors a business of the week or something like that, would highlight certain businesses. And, foster their development.
If I'm making the recommendation that you don't grandfather, that once we get it to completion and it becomes available as that zone, that you put it out there as much as possible and make a grace period. Come in here, get, because you want those people to be registered.
Why?
Because the county has liability if something happens.
What's the county liable for?
They just got sued.
No.
The city house, they had a railing break. People sat on it. We didn't do our job.
You know, the county had been suing them and fighting them for how many years?
Years. It wasn't that we didn't do enough.
The county didn't do enough.
Yeah. They exhausted their insurance. And they got, what, was it $1.5 million or $2 million?
Yes, $1.5 million, I think.
Yeah.
But would they file for a home occupancy? No, they were above that, weren't they?
They were on expense for five.
They have a home occupancy for three houses and one ground level unit.
They're way ahead of that.
They built it. They weren't zoned for it in the first place. They bought the county.
They did everything after the fact.
Yeah. But there's no one zoned for it right now.
So, after that, you've got to be very careful.
Well, I agree with that, but that's the whole issue is that the county's. Let me rephrase that. The courts don't make people responsible for their own actions anymore. So we need as much as possible to get people to register and have the proper certification.
it does help individual business owners with their insurance. They happen to have somebody on their property who's visiting there for the business. First thing, when someone gets injured on the property, the first thing they're going to look for, are you registered business? If not, that's a thing against you. And that's a reason for someone's insurance company to say, look, you're operating outside the bounds of your homeowner's insurance, we're not going to cover that.
It also gives neighboring proprietors some form of redress of grievance. Because if there's nothing,
right,
it's just a free-for-all.
Right. I mean, and those are the issues, frankly, that the subcommittee has been balancing with.
Yeah.
If you're a property owner living next door or you're the business owner, what are your expectations moving into that neighborhood?
Anyway, do you have some general updated planning issue?
I've got two things I want to relate to three things to the planning commission. One is that the budget cuts have hit us. We lost a staff person at the end of January. Debbie Coder is no longer working for us, administrative secretary. Our budget has been affected by the downfall in development activity. We're about 25% off the projected budget revenue for this year. That's part of the reason that position was eliminated. And I'm going to do what I can in this upcoming budget hearing to keep our office whole. A lot of what we do is serving the public that's not covered by development fees. I want to point out that in January, we had 313 people walk through the door and ask us questions about developing property. We're only open 20 hours a week. That's a pretty big figure. And in fact, we had more people in January than we had in July, which is unusual. But a good thing, because usually those walk-in people, walk-in customers, turn into permanent players. So we're seeing a great potential there. We just haven't seen revenue coming through the door yet. Related to that, the planning department will be presenting our budget to the budget committee in April and May. And I'll try to keep you apprised of sort of where we stand. That's your staff support to this commission. Because of a lot of what we have on our plate in the upcoming months, both in dealing with the LDAC recommendations, and the Home Occupation Tax Amendment, and then the wireless code, we don't collect fees for that. So that comes out of the general fund. That's essentially the public making an application and not writing a check. Or at least a check comes out of the general fund, not out of the account. One more thing I want to bring to your attention was, actually two more things. One was the FEMA database of letters of map amendment. Back in 2009, when the county was under an enforcement agreement from enforcement letter from FEMA, we were told that we were supposed to publish a list of letters of map amendment. FEMA maps changed in 2009, and many more properties became part of the floodplain and were notified by their insurers that they now need to get flood insurance. In response to that, many property owners have what's called a letter of map amendment, and that takes your particular structure or a portion of your property out of the 100-year floodplain. We keep a record of those letters of map amendment, but we have not, till now, distributed that list of letters of map amendment to insurance companies, title companies, and board of realtors. We're now going to do that. We put the database into one easily readable Excel document. We're going to post that on the county's website. We'll send it out to the lenders, the insurance agents, the title companies, and realtors. So they're aware when someone's in the 100-year floodplain, if there is a letter of map amendment that exempts that structure, they'll know that coming in. And the last item was that I didn't bring a copy with me, but the planning department put together a document called Starting Your Business in Josephine County. That's for businesses that start up in commercial and industrial areas. And that was approved by the Board of Commissioners. There are 10 copies down at the board's office. There are 20 at the Chamber of Commerce and 20 at the Small Business Development Center. We'll be taking those documents and posting them on the county website. Basically, it's a step-by-step guide. It you come in, you want to start a business here on commercial industrial properties, not in the home occupation zones, but in those commercial industrial zones, if you want to start a business, here's how to do it. And we did that at the request of the Chamber of Commerce.
Did the Chamber help pay for it?
No. That's all I have.
Okay. One other thing, we get this out here. We're tentatively looking at bringing in road amendments to a hearing on the 16th April. Still good there? Okay. So mark that on your calendar. On
the 16th of April?
Yeah. It's tax day, so special.
Yeah.
Do we have dates for the other meetings?
Well, we also talked about bringing Article 76 and those changes with to the same hearing.
And then how about the building committee?
Really?
Yeah, I have to get the road.
Well, there might be continued hearings, but because those two are pretty closely tied, we've got driveway standards, which are into the road standards, and we felt that those two issues pretty much went together. Deer winter range is a whole other kettle of fish.
What's on March 5th here? On the calendar, we have a hearing. Let's say planning commission.
Yeah.
Very bottom of the front page.
I got nothing.
I don't have anything.
So
we're not
going to
have a meeting.
There's nothing listed in there.
So we can write no.
Oh, there's nothing. Okay, I understand.
Those are potential dates.
Okay, so
we just put all the Mondays on the calendar.
I wanted to thank staff for this good staff report. It's really helped me solidify things. Okay. It was a hell of a lot of work.
That was all the road. It's
all the storage.
Yeah.
You have to say it's the whole place over. Okay, so thank you.
Next meeting is on
April 30th.
Yes.
That's the next
7 o'clock in, but over hearing, right?
Yeah.
When you're 7 o'clock on the 1st.
Yes.
I've got a question that is not relative to this committee, and probably nobody wants to hear it, but for about 3 years I started calling the planning office. I believe I talked to Roger, I talked to somebody else in there, and there's a house over on 630 Roby Lane. If you go down Lower River Road, you go up Roby Lane, and it's been sitting there vacant, and the weeds are really tall, and there's an overflowing septic tank, and it's pretty nasty. And it's a big piece of property, and I don't know who owns it, and I don't know who's supposed to take care of it, but it's looking pretty shabby out there, and I believe, I'm pretty sure it's coming right. But I don't know what can be done about something like that.
You can do a complaint form. You can fill out your name and address, and give it to the code enforcement officer. Or you can talk to DEQ if you think it's a health violation. And the DEQ, if it's a septic thing, they will act on it. Countywide is our process.
It's been vacant for nearly 2 years.
Not because
of the septic tank
we were
pulling. I don't know.
There's a high water table out there. That's all floodplain.
Yeah. That's a good question. I live in the front yard one. It's in the front yard.
Okay, well, I'll move to adjourn.
Oh, water is really good.